Bearing in mind the Apostle Paul's words in Romans chapter 15, verse 4, "For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning," I want to spend a short time this evening looking at this man, Obadiah, of whom we read earlier, to understand something of his faith and of his experience with God. We know very little about this man who was governor of Ahab's house, probably like his chief civil servant. But I think he was a remarkable man, and what little we do know is instructive and humbling. I suspect that our experience with God may be quite like Obadiah's. And I think that Obadiah has some things to teach us as we look together at his relationship with the Lord. For those of us who grew up in a world strongly influenced by Christianity, these can be disturbing days. No longer is the Christian voice necessarily respected. No longer can we assume that the average person has much understanding of what happens in church. Many of us find this threatening, and we may be fearful for the church. But in many ways, our situation is closer to the days of Ahab's rule in Israel, of which we read. How then, we may ask, may believers conduct themselves in such societies? The background to this passage that we read was that Ahab, encouraged by Baal, by his Baal-worshipping wife Jezebel, intended to kill Elijah, who, as we read in chapter 17, had 3 years earlier prophesied to him that God was sending a drought as judgment on Israel's idolatry and apostasy. Ahab thought he was the most powerful man in Israel, and yet he was helpless to stop the drought. No matter how many prayers he offered to Baal, the heavens were shut up and the rain would not come. To make matters worse for Ahab, Elijah, protected by the Lord, had disappeared. No one knew where he was. No one had seen him since that all-important moment when he had delivered his message from the Lord to Ahab. Where had he gone? Ahab had stopped at nothing to answer that question. In chapter 18, verse 10, we read the lengths he had gone to find him. Obadiah tells us that we read that he sent soldiers on a manhunt to the surrounding nations. In his frenzy to capture Elijah, he not only searched other countries, but he made their leaders swear they didn't know where the prophet was. But try as he might, Ahab couldn't find the man who had, in the name of the Lord, announced the start of the drought and famine to his land. We note that there wasn't the slightest acknowledgement from Ahab that his own apostasy and refusal to turn the nation to the true God of Israel could be the cause of the drought. Not the slightest hint of acknowledgement of that fact. Eventually the word of the Lord came to Elijah again, "Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land." It must have come as a relief to Elijah to know that the time had come to confront the wicked king once again. Elijah may have wondered why he had to wait by the brook and then in the widow's home for so long while a tide of wickedness swept over his homeland. Whatever he thought and however he prayed, he did nothing until the Lord directed him. He waited until God's time had ripened, until the fullness of God's purposes could be revealed. Only then did he go in search of Ahab. But it was not Ahab that he met at first. As he journeyed from Zarephath to Samaria, Elijah met Obadiah. Obadiah was combing the land at Ahab's command to find grass to feed Ahab's starving animals. Ahab's desperation about the animals wasn't just out of concern for the animals' welfare. We need to understand that Ahab's army depended on horses for the chariot forces. In a very real way, the drought threatened Ahab's government, economically and militarily. And we read that Ahab was trying to find food for his animals. He went in one direction, but we note that he delegated the responsibility for the other direction to Obadiah. Now, let us consider Obadiah's position. As we have noted, Obadiah was governor of Ahab's house, Ahab's chief civil servant, his right-hand man, the one who kept everything running smoothly, taking care of all the details so that Ahab could get on with being king. Obadiah must have been a man of considerable talent to rise so high, because this was a position with enormous responsibility. He was in charge of everything that happened in Ahab's house, his palace. This would mean that he had oversight of all the servants, the aides, and the people who came in and out to see the king. And this certainly meant that Ahab must have known him well and placed a great deal of trust in him. We see that in the fact that he delegated to Obadiah the responsibility for going in the other direction. He trusted Obadiah implicitly. So Obadiah occupied a position of great responsibility in society's corridors of power. But then we must note that he stood for the Lord during this time of great national apostasy. When others were turning to idolatry, this man, elevated to high position, would not bow the knee to Baal. He somehow managed to serve the Lord and keep his high position, even while serving a king bent on leading the people astray. We must recognize, therefore, that it pleased the Lord to place this godly man in a position that must have been very difficult for him, serving a wicked king like Ahab. Just as Joseph, and much later Daniel, Nehemiah, and Mordecai, in other Old Testament accounts, rose to positions of great influence and responsibility in the governments of evil leaders, so did Obadiah. What do we know about his faith? Well, we are told that he was a devout believer in the Lord, in verse 3. And by his own testimony, in verse 12, that he feared the Lord from his youth. Charles Spurgeon, the great Baptist preacher, commented on this, saying that Obadiah was an example of early eminent piety, commenting that God had ordained that Obadiah be raised in this way. What a blessing is a godly upbringing. Then we are told that while Jezebel was killing off the Lord's prophets, Obadiah hid 100 of the Lord's prophets in a cave to keep Jezebel from killing them, and that he supplied those prophets with food and water to keep them alive. We may wonder if he smuggled food out of Ahab's house to feed the prophets. Few of us would envy Obadiah working in a position of responsibility for a godless and ruthless master, but clearly he was prepared to take huge risks to do the right thing. When Elijah and Obadiah met, Obadiah showed due respect for the prophet, falling on his face before him. But in a very matter-of-fact way, Elijah simply confirmed his own identity and told Obadiah to go and announce his arrival. Obadiah was reticent to do so, afraid that if Ahab could not then find Elijah, his own life would be in danger. He was put in the position of telling Ahab that he's just seen the king's number one enemy. Spurgeon also makes the point that while it cannot be proved, it would seem to make some sense. He suggested that Elijah probably didn't have much patience with Obadiah's hesitation. For when Elijah told him to go and tell Ahab where he was, Obadiah obviously considered it would be a virtual death sentence for himself. All he knew was that Elijah had shown up at the king's court 3 years earlier and suddenly disappeared without trace. And now Elijah had shown up again. If Obadiah were to go to the king and say, "I found Elijah," how would he know that Elijah wouldn't disappear again? That was an understandable question, but he did know that the Spirit of the Lord would be active in that disappearance if it were to be so. Maybe this was a moment of human weakness, but I think that Obadiah would have been ready to risk death for what he believed. He had already done that when hiding the prophets, but perhaps he didn't want to be killed for what he thought to be no reason at all. However, he recovered his courage and did trust Elijah's word, being reassured when Elijah agreed to meet Ahab himself later that day. We must admire and commend Obadiah for his heroism in hiding the prophets of the Lord from Jezebel. If he'd been found out, surely she would have had him put to death on the spot. He knew that, but anyway, he hid them away, and he risked his life to give them food and water. He was no coward. Let me go back to Spurgeon's point for a moment. He begins this way. He says, and I quote, "I suspect that Elijah did not think very much of Obadiah. He doesn't treat him with any great consideration, but addresses him more abruptly than one would expect from a fellow believer. Elijah was the man of action, bold, always to the front with nothing to conceal. Obadiah was a quiet believer, true and steadfast, but in a very difficult position, and therefore driven to perform his duty in a less open manner. Elijah would never have served in Ahab's court. Such a thought would have been abhorrent to him. But that was evidently exactly where God had placed Obadiah. And nowhere in the account that is it suggested that Obadiah was not where he should have been. On the contrary, it was because where he was where he was and doing what he did that he was able to save the 100 prophets from Jezebel's wicked crusade. So despite his fear, he eventually was willing to pass on Elijah's message to the king, even though it still put his life at risk. The time had come when Obadiah recognized he must stand up and be counted, and he agreed to act as a messenger for Elijah, whom Ahab perceived as his greatest enemy. The danger of playing such a role is that one can be tempted to be compromised, timid and anxious about one's reputation. How did Obadiah handle the challenge? Well, we don't have a lot of detail, but we do note that he maintained his faith. How easy it is in a secular environment to lose the freshness of our relationship with the Lord and gradually slip into habits of complaining, or to allow our ethical standards to become fuzzy at the edges, while God seems less and less relevant to our dangerous real-life situations. But we read that Obadiah was a devout believer, not a closet compromiser. Though he continued to serve in Ahab's household, he did not lose his faith, but remained a devout and presumably praying man. He took advantage of the opportunities offered to him by his job, hiding and feeding those prophets. Our jobs may seem mundane, but all of us have opportunities to live a distinctively Christian life. In the way we behave towards our colleagues, in our conscientiousness and integrity. And many of us, as we attain to positions of responsibility, will have real opportunities to change things, to encourage and support younger colleagues, to review dodgy sales methods, to initiate and support policies that promote justice. Obadiah's have responsibility, friends, to use the position of power and influence that God has given them to protect the vulnerable and innocent, like Obadiah did, to be willing to face up to unjust authority when it is called for. The time may come for us when the Lord convinces us that we must make a stand on an issue of principle, to challenge or identify ourselves with those who are challenging corruption, mismanagement and discrimination. The Reverend Ian Hamilton, trustee of the Banner of Truth Trust and former minister of Cambridge Presbyterian Church, commenting on this passage on his blog to his congregation some years ago, asked, "What can we learn from this brave, devout servant of the Lord?" And I quote, he says, "Perhaps above all this, we should be slow to judge fellow believers who do not separate themselves from national and ecclesiastical evil in precisely the way we may have done ourselves. We can too easily make ourselves the standard that everyone else should be guided by. We can surely assume that because he was a devout believer, he refused to compromise his allegiance to Jehovah in the midst of national and ecclesiastical apostasy. Yes, we no longer live in a church state," he says, "but there is a principle here that we should ponder carefully. Not all good men and women are called by God to react in the same way to moral and theological evil. Of course we must all, without exception, hate evil in all its forms and refuse to be party to it in any way. But God may call us to work out that rejection of evil in different ways." Reverend Hamilton says, "Elijah was separated from the evil. Obadiah was left in the midst of it to serve God and his church quietly, yet faithfully." And I end the quote. So God needs Christian believers who are willing to be prophets like Elijah, people who are prepared to speak unpalatable truth, who are willing to put their heads above the parapet to expose corruption and injustice and challenge flawed policy regardless of the personal cost. But God also needs Obadiahs who will accept responsibility within society's flawed institutions, in the civil service, the health service, professional bodies, workers' unions, and local and national government even, in order to be salt and light, to safeguard services for the most vulnerable, and to care with compassion for the most needy. We must all remember to pray for those like Obadiah in places of responsibility and authority, that God would encourage them in their walk with him, help them to stay true to the truth, grant them wisdom and protect them from mischievous complaints and slander, which are so much a feature of today's society. And most importantly, God needs the Elijahs and the Obadiahs to work together, respecting, enabling and encouraging one another, for the extension of his kingdom and for his glory. Is there room in the kingdom for both Obadiah's and Elijah's. The obvious answer to this question from this passage is yes. Though the two men were very different in their personality and position, both were obedient servants of God. A good example of the unity Christ prayed for believers in John 17. We must note too that God sometimes calls others to do things that we ourselves simply could not do. If God has called them, he will supply them and give them whatever they need. To say this is not to make any allowance for spiritual compromise. Those who serve Caesar may find that they too must hide God's prophets at considerable risk to themselves. God has all sorts of people in his family. Elijah had a rough road to follow from the beginning, but it wouldn't have been easy to be in Obadiah's shoes either. Most often the focus in these chapters in 1 Kings is rightly on the great prophet of the Lord, Elijah. But in God's providence, different believers have different callings. Elijah was called to confront evil from the outside, while Obadiah was called to subversively work and to restrain it from within. Now, as we noted earlier, Obadiah wasn't the only devout Old Testament believer God put in a hard place of responsibility. In the New Testament, we meet a woman named Joanna, who was King Herod's household manager. Joanna, in Luke 8:3, was one of the women who went eventually to Jesus' tomb on Easter morning. Imagine working in Herod's palace, the very place where John the Baptist was beheaded. And Philippians chapter 4, verse 22 tells us that there were saints in Caesar's household. So we may understand from this that God has his people in some very unlikely places. Perhaps most believers have callings more like Obadiah than Elijah. Perhaps you're working in a place where things go on which you're not comfortable with. Like Obadiah, the majority of Christians today work for unbelieving employers. Most basically honest and just, but some corrupt and tyrannical. Should they resign and retreat into the comparative safety of Christian employment? Or, believing that the salt should be applied to the food, the lamp placed on a stand, should they stay where they are and try to make a difference, as Obadiah did when he rescued the 100 prophets? Whether you are an Elijah or an Obadiah, may God guide, strengthen, and equip you, and give you courage. Both of these men needed God's enabling and encouragement. May God give wisdom to all those in such positions of responsibility in our government today.